Welcome to the Power Hour. I'm Adrienne Herbert, wellness coach, international speaker, and author. Each week, I speak to a variety of guests, from business founders to Olympic athletes, leading coaches, change makers, and innovators, to find out their daily habits, their rules to live by, and what motivates them to get up out of bed each day. Personally, I am on a mission to encourage, motivate, and inspire, so I hope that the Power Hour will help you to achieve your personal and professional goals. Welcome back to the Power Hour podcast. Today's guest is on a mission to lead a reproductive revolution, and the company that she founded, Hertility, aims to put an accessible and affordable health service in the hands of women everywhere. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Helen O'Neill.
Thanks for having me.
I'm so excited for this conversation. Honestly, I think there's so much. I almost thought before you came today, that last week I was prepping, I thought, where do I start? Because I suppose where I'm at, you know, I'm a 36-year-old woman. I have got a lot of friends who are either mid-30s, early-30s, late-30s, some 40s, and some 20s. But I think there's a lot of conversation in my peer group right now about, you know, people having their first, or people thinking that they, if they're not with someone, like, oh gosh, how long have I got? Biological clock ticking, all of that. And I'm also, because I had my son when I was 23, so, and, you know, got divorced, and I now have also other friends, mum friends, who are going through menopause. I've got other friends who are going through divorces and blended families. So there's just so much, I think, when it comes to the topic of female fertility, and it just touched, there's so many touch points, I think, within all of our lives. So I have a lot of questions, but before we dive into them, I just kind of mentioned there, you know, that you're the founder of this company, and, you know, it's not an easy thing to do, female founder. I guess we could talk a little bit about that first, what Hertility is all about and why you decided, I know that you're a lecturer as well, why you decided to start this company.
So I think the decision was something that was a long time coming. What was strange was that it wasn't a decision that was a professional one per se. It was just as much a personal one. And it wasn't that I decided to start a company. I decided to find out more. And in order to do so, that's how the company was created. So what I mean by that is that I have spent many, many years doing a master's, a PhD, a postdoc, lecturing master students, medical students, really just immersing myself in the world of women's health, reproduction, fertilization, embryology, you name it, all of the different things associated with fertility. But at the end of it, I was none the wiser about my own. And in fact, when you're surrounded by a lot of information, inevitably you're surrounded by quite grim statistics. And, you know, what are the chances of, and what are the likelihood of, and look at the prevalence of. And you can't help but feel, I guess, paranoid that maybe you might be one of them. And I remember one day in the lab looking at a sample from a patient for whom they were undergoing genetic testing for their embryos. So they weren't infertile, but they were undergoing this journey to have a baby. And looking at the date of birth, thinking, oh my gosh, it's the same as mine. Like, what sign is this to think that here I am, really quite blissfully continuing, thinking I'm still in my 20s, but really in my 30s, thinking, how amazing my ability to ignore those statistics and not apply them to myself. Yes, I had this underlying worry, but not being in that position at all and thinking, this woman who's born on the same day as me is undergoing a very different journey and is in a very, as a result of that, gone through a different life stage already. And it really got me thinking. I just thought, well, I'm not in a position to do that financially, in terms of a relationship, anything actually, career-wise, and feeling so frustrated that it all seemed so unfair that I could work so hard to get to where I was and yet still be unqualified in terms of our global expectation of women, which is that you've only passed the successful criteria of being a woman once you've procreated, and thinking, this is fucked, actually. Yeah. This is fucked. That I firstly just wanted to know. And, you know, when you're in a field, like, you, it's an echo chamber, right? You hear all the same stats, you hear all of the same threats, warnings, but also you hear quite frequently about the procedures and how medicalized things become quite routine to you. And so quite flippantly, I was told by many of my colleagues, you just freeze your eggs. Just freeze your eggs.
Easy as that.
Easy as that. And I was like, yeah, that's fine. And I had literally vitrified, which is to freeze an egg or an oocyte, albeit a mouse oocyte, because we'd undergone different experimental procedures, etc., to learn more about it. But being the patient on the side of that was a very different feeling. And I felt quite lost. And all I could think after my first appointment, and actually being dismissed and told, you're a baby, come back when you're 35.
I'm
thinking, that's just not good advice. But actually, maybe it wasn't bad advice, right? And I just wanted to know, was I okay? Actually, all I wanted to know was that reassurance. Am I okay? Am I one of the statistics on the lower end or the higher end or the mid? And that really has just been like the evolution of creating fertility and something that enables women to check in and know where they are personally.
Wow, so much in there. And I think when you said around education, and you know, you're in that environment because you're literally in the lab, so you're hearing all the stats, hearing all the data, hearing all the information. So of course that's to a level good thing because you have the knowledge, but it's also overwhelming. And I actually think, although people are not in a lab and they're not, you know, doing what you did, I do think, you know, I just spent 5 minutes looking on Google, and if you just type in anything to do with, you know, female fertility in the UK, you see all of the most popular search terms. Mm. So you see all of the questions that other people are looking for. And I think because there is so much information, and I suppose in a good way, like democratizing, you know, the literacy of our health, but it's also just like, what do you do with that information? This is like a fire hose of information that comes at you. And the most searched questions that came up when I just spent 5 minutes on Google were, is it safe to get pregnant after the age of 35? Is it harder to get pregnant after 35? What are natural ways to improve fertility? How to improve your chance of having twins? How much does fertility treatment cost in the UK? Those were the top searches that people are asking on Google right now in 2024. So that got me thinking. But when you just described that journey that you had yourself, information, 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 what do people do with it? And as I said, there's also a lot of misconceptions as well. So I think that might even be my next question for you, which is, which misconceptions or myths about female fertility would you like to debunk for us today?
I think it's mostly around applying one rule or one stat and making that applicable to every woman. I think we really need to move beyond some of the big statements that can be harmful or unhelpful and start to think much more in terms of personalized medicine. The reason we've never been able to create personalized medicine type statistics for individuals is because we just don't have the data. And so really we're just lacking in enough information to be for anyone to be qualified to give distinct answers. It's part of our biggest mission is to create the largest data set in the world of female fertility and gynecological pathologies so that we can help each individual as a person. You know, sometimes I get annoyed with the whole fertility cliff, the 35-year-old fertility cliff, because...
Yeah, let's maybe zoom in on that, because obviously the word, the age 35, it comes up a lot. Now, I know some other stats actually say 30, and, you know, it's like, there is obviously, of course, data and there's truth in this, right? It's not just a made-up number that people say, oh, once you get to this age, or... Because we kind of hear both sides. I feel like you hear some people saying, don't worry about it. You know what? Have your career, do your thing, don't rush, you can have kids. Look, people are having kids naturally all the time. People are having kids when they're 40, don't worry about it. Then you hear the other side, typically people's mothers, telling them, you have to hurry up, your biological clock is ticking, and after the age of 30, or dreaded 35, then that's it, you've had it. And so how can both people be saying, you know, these completely different things, statements, and is there truth in it?
I guess there's truth in both statements. You'll always hear the success stories of my mum had me in her 40s, or I naturally conceived when I was 40 or when I was 35. You're less likely to hear the 28, 29, 30 year olds who are going through quite miserable, lonely and quite devastating journeys to have a child, because they're not the ones shouting about it. Yes, there are many more advocates now for infertility and people talking about their fertility journeys. But up until now, we don't hear those voices. Those are the ones that are muted and are quite frankly, just disillusioned with everything. And for me, I think it's about putting data, more than just data, it's about saying what types of individuals are more likely to be at risk of being infertile at 35. And what are the types of individuals and life factors that contribute to that, that allow someone to actually be able to conceive beyond that? And the biggest, I guess, misconception, which I love the perfect pun, about all of it is that it's down to one person. It doesn't matter if you are as fertile as can be at 30, 35 or 40. If your partner is not fertile, you are going to be an infertile couple and you are going to struggle to conceive. And that, I think, is the biggest thing we never talk about, is the other side of the coin.
Yep.
You know, conversely, you can be not fertile and your partner is very fertile and you're still, you're going to fall within that same bracket. It takes two to tango, and data doesn't really account for both parties. Mm. There are many people who've gone through long and arduous and expensive and difficult fertility journeys, actually sometimes resulting in divorce. And as soon as they get with somebody else, they instantly get pregnant. And it makes you wonder, like, why do we not talk more about that other 50%, which is so important when it comes to your fertility?
Absolutely. This is the thing. It's always missing from the conversation. I'm so grateful that you said that, because I've definitely had, you know, a challenging fertility journey. A lot of people probably don't know that, to be honest, but I had a very challenging fertility journey after I had my first son. And, you know, people just look at you, the woman, and they just go, oh, well, it must be you. And they just kind of, you know, throw their advice on you. Sometimes they mean well, but, you know, as a mum with, you know, I think when my son was maybe 2 or 3 or 4, when they start school, everybody, especially because I love kids, everybody starts looking at you and going, oh, when are you going to have another baby? Yeah. Oh, when are you going to have another baby? They don't know if you've just had a miscarriage. They don't know if you're doing fertility treatment. They don't know if your husband's sperm doesn't work. You know? And this is the thing. I also had a friend who had a similar, you know, different but similar experience, because her husband had testicular cancer. Mm. And they got told when they were very young that he had testicular cancer and that they were going to have to, I think, take the sperm out before, you know, all these things. And, you know, she had to freeze her eggs and there was all these things. And it was like, oh, would we be able to have children in the future? Because they didn't want to have children right there and then. But again, it was all these conversations, discussions, pressures, decisions that the woman has to also, you know, go through. Your body, if you're going to do fertility treatment, you have to do the hormones, the injections, the things. And as you said before, someone goes, oh, freeze your eggs, or oh, do IVF, or they just throw these things out as if it's like going to the dentist. Or, I mean, yeah, it's a whole thing. And you just thrown in going, okay, just do that. Ta-da, easy solution. And it is so complex. And I think, yeah, for any couples who are experiencing that, it's just a minefield. It's so exhausting. Everybody, like I said, meaning well people will just constantly be telling you, oh, you should drink this Chinese tea that I had, or you should put your legs up the wall when you do this, or you should do acupuncture, or you know what, Adrienne, you run a lot, don't you? You should probably stop doing that. You should probably gain weight because you're too slim. But then if you're overweight, you're too fat. And there's just constant things.
It's never-ending.
And you're just like, you know what, this is why I didn't probably share that much about it at the time, was because I just thought, wow, this is a lot, even just for me and my husband at the time, without every single person like wading in. So I'm really grateful that you said that actually, yeah, it's two people, you know, trying to conceive a baby, and often it can be, you know, really complicated. But I guess could you give us an overview? So right now, current state of, and we are focusing at the moment on female fertility in the UK. So are there any signals, any trends, obviously with the research, that broadly speaking, are things improving over time? Are things staying the same? Are things dramatically getting worse? Like, are there any trends? What's the kind of broad overview right now?
So from an infertility trend, the number of individuals who are going for IVF are increasing. The rate of infertility is increasing. The success rates of fertility treatment have stayed the same for a very long time. And your likelihood within the UK of being referred for NHS funded treatment is very, very slim. So we actually wanted to look, because so many people say to me, having a company, to me, like I said, I didn't want to create a company. I wanted to create something that gave me answers, that enabled me, when I had conversations with my friends or out, to say, here is something you can do. Because it's very frustrating to be somebody who's dedicated so much of your life to understanding things. And when someone asks you a basic question like, how do I know what my fertility is? Thinking, I should be able to help you. Mm. And knowing that if they're passed through the NHS, they have to wait for at least 12 to 24 months, depending on their age, before they're even assessed, and going through different criteria. So you're not eligible if you're single. You're not eligible if you're in a relationship with somebody who has a child with a previous person.
Which is wild.
You're Come not on. Eligible if your ovarian reserve is already below a certain level. So, okay, well, surely that would be the people that need help. You're not eligible if your BMI is a certain. You're not eligible if you live within a certain area.
Who is eligible? Like, well, the unicorn, basically.
This is exactly what we wanted to find out. Like, who is actually eligible? And we looked at data from, you know, over 200,000 women who'd filled out our comprehensive health assessment, who'd given us bloods, to say, of these women trying to conceive or even planning for future babies, how many of them would ever be eligible for NHS funded treatment? 70% would never be eligible. And yet they'd still be told, wait for 12 months and come back, keep trying. And so for me, that is very frustrating, to be robbed of the most important thing that you have when it comes to fertility, which is your time. Mm. And then only to be told, sorry, you're going to have to go privately.
And time, but also money. Because let's be honest, that is a big divide between people that can and people that cannot. Yes. And for myself, when I did fertility treatment and we had to fund it ourselves, because as you said, not eligible. You know, that wasn't something at the time that I could afford, to be honest. But when you are so desperate to have a baby, whether that's a sibling for your baby, whether it's your first child, it doesn't matter. You will do anything. And I think people do become very, you know, don't use this word lightly, but, you know, I know friends right now that are going through the challenge of trying to conceive their first child, and it puts so much of a strain on so many things. And you can become obsessed, you can become desperate, you can become like, you know, what I mean by obsessed is, you know, constantly tracking every single month, every single thing.
It's soul destroying.
Yeah. And then if someone says, oh, it's going to cost you this much, you know, what will people sacrifice? Essentially, I think people will sacrifice anything. And they will find the money.
I always say a woman would give you her arm.
Exactly.
To conceive.
Yeah. And they might take a loan, or they might get in debt. And, you know, people who I know, people have said that when they've done multiple rounds of failing IVF and ended up with, you know, thousands and thousands of thousands of pounds of debt, which they can't afford. Yeah. Like, imagine the stress on top of that.
Well, that was the other side of the equation that I just felt like I could send you to the NHS. You're not going to get far. I could send you to a private fertility clinic, and I don't feel honest doing that, because frankly, I as an individual, as an academic, as a scientist at the time, was like, well, I can't afford that option. So why would I give that to you as a viable option? And where was that in between option that enabled you to actually just check in affordably? And that's really where fertility came. So it infuriates me when people say that £149 for a test that is a full consultation, that has a gynecologist written report, that has, we've spent 2 years building predictive algorithms on. I'm like, £149 is not expensive. And we don't even, I can't tell you how much we sacrifice to bring everything to an affordable level to say, this is what we can get by. Like, we can survive as a company with this amount. Yeah. And everyone says, for the amount of work you've done, for the fact that it's essentially like 3 appointments in one, between analysing bloods, between taking the health assessment, between all the gynecologists and the report and the tech, this needs to be more expensive. And I have dug my heels in and said, this needs to be affordable to everybody. Mm. And that's something I feel really passionately about. And I guess inevitably you can't please everybody. But that to me was the middle ground that I really wanted to achieve. It was something that, it not shoving somebody through a very long and arduous journey in the NHS where you're justifying it, or sending somebody to a private fertility clinic where essentially they're inevitably going to be put through the mill, right? You don't go to a fertility clinic where they go, here are the things that you might do to improve your fertility.
Well, that's, I guess,
it's not really in their business interest to do that.
Yeah, and I guess that's where we come to next, because as you said, so if things are broadly speaking not improving, I suppose there's modern world challenges. So lifestyle, environment, I'm always thinking that, because I think this is the work, you know, I work in the health and wellbeing industry and I have done for a long time. And I always think about that. Okay, so is our modern world lifestyle? What are the things, whether it's stress, and, you know, stress is finally, I think, getting its moment, and people understanding the impact it has on, you know, on our biology. Is it diet? Is it, you know, what is it? But are there some things, hopefully there are, that people can do to, regardless whether they're trying to get pregnant right now, but just to improve their overall fertility? And what are those things? Are they just the obvious things that we kind of should be doing? Sleeping well, eating well? Because if you're doing all those things already, it's quite frustrating, isn't it, when someone says, well, healthy lifestyle, and people go, I couldn't be any healthier. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, I do think it's hard when you're given advice that you're like, I'm trying my best to do all of those things. For me, what's quite strange is when I look at our data, because I'm looking for key distinct markers that could lead somebody to be at a higher risk for whether it's a pathology, whether it's a hormone imbalance. And then we look at the most basic of things that are contributing to reduced fertility, like alcohol intake, like smoking, now vaping. We just submitted our research to present at the European Society for Reproductive Embryology, statistically showing that vaping actually does decrease your ovarian reserve. And so it's amazing to have a significant amount of data to back that, where before there's a lot of data on smoking and its impact, but none on vaping.
What's the data there on alcohol? Because I know some friends who, as soon as they started trying to conceive, were like, I'm not drinking because I'm trying to get pregnant.
Yeah.
But if you've been drinking, you know, quite a lot for the last 15 years, is that going to be playing a part as well?
I think that's one of the biggest generational differences between, you know, millennials have been a generation that have drank a lot and have done so from a very young age. And that's compounded by the fact that, you know, if you start drinking at 15, which a lot of people do, and then consistently throughout your 20s, and especially in university where it's almost seen as a rite of passage that you ruin yourself, which I actually despise that. I despise the fact that it's like they're just in college. It's a college lifestyle. It's a university lifestyle, whatever. And I just, I hope that it doesn't bleed into another generation. And I think where people are now starting to attack big food, you know, first it was like big pharma, then big tobacco. Now people are really attacking big food
and
ultra processed foods. Yeah. I think next is alcohol. Like, right. And this push to normalize a drug that has the biggest impact on our health, our mental health, our well-being, on societal structures. Like, we probably wouldn't need police at nighttime if it weren't for the fact that alcohol is such an enabler for violence, for, you know, just danger and sloppy behavior. But it's been so normalized and accepted and actually pushed that we have people who've spent basically 25 years drinking pretty heavily, and expecting everything to be fine. And that's unfair and it's shit. But actually, we really tend to separate out our expectations for damage. And what I mean by that is, when you smoke, you say it affects my lungs. When you drink, you say it affects my liver. But actually, when you drink, watch somebody, they lose their balance, they lose their cognition, they lose
their clothes, their inhibitions.
They lose everything, right? It affects so much more. How can we exclude our ovaries from that? Mm-hmm. You know, we can't. But nobody really cares to deep dive into that. And so one of the most stark realities from our data was looking to see, of those who were actively trying to conceive, how many were drinking like a lot. And close to 50% of people are drinking still.
Okay.
But nearly 10% of those are drinking way above the national limit. I mean, more than 14 units, like a lot. Yeah. So you're like, that's something we could easily remove. But then when you go to other more extreme things that you would think are intuitive, like don't take drugs. Please don't take drugs while you're trying to conceive. I don't think it's a good idea.
Yeah.
But 8.6% of people who are actively trying to conceive are still taking recreational drugs. And you just think, okay, we need to have a conversation about what's good for you and what's
connecting
bad for
the
you.
Dots, yeah.
But nobody's going to start with the most basic of things, which is stop drinking altogether. Definitely cut out the drugs.
So lifestyle pieces. And I think, you know, I guess, because it can be quite stressful, can't it? And we've said, you know, some of the kind of doom and gloom and the kind of some of the stats that come up straight away. Yes, they might be true about, you know, your egg reserve and the biological clock. Those stats, I'm sure, are true. You can tell us. But I think the holistic piece and the mind piece and the emotion piece is what's often missing.
Yeah.
And as I said, when I had that experience of fertility treatment, it was so clinical. Mm-hmm. You know, it's clinical. Everything from the measurements, the bloods, the injections, the invasive procedures, everything is like just medical. And at the time, I mean, this was how many years ago? This was 8 years ago. So maybe it's changed. But there was no conversation really around mental health, as me, person. How I felt. There was no conversation about emotion, feeling. And I think, because also I'm not that kind of person either. I tend to lean more into like data and facts. Give me, you know, I wanted to know, okay, if I'm going to go through this, what are the odds? What are the chances? Give me numbers. Yeah. I wasn't probably at the time, I would be now. I wasn't really that kind of holistic, oh, how do I actually feel about this? Or how do I actually feel today? But I think regardless of whether someone's doing fertility treatment, whether they're trying to conceive, or the single person who's like, you know what, I'm not in a relationship right now where I can even have this conversation. What needs to be done, I suppose? How much, you know, in with fertility, with the data, the research, as you said, you're seeing, okay, the stats and the data around things like age and alcohol and these things. What support do you think people need emotionally? How is our like emotional well-being being taken care of when it comes to our fertility concerns?
One of the first questions that we ask in our health assessment when we're onboarding you is, how are you feeling? And it's amazing the feedback that people will say, I'm actually just so grateful you asked. But far, what we ask are, how are you feeling? Calm, confident and relaxed, neutral, stressed, or completely stressed and overwhelmed. And 60% of people categorize themselves as stressed or completely stressed and overwhelmed. And that is shocking. Like, that to me is a true reflection of the society we live in, that we live such lives that are just impacted by the rush, the work, the go, the impulses, the interruptions, the technology, that we're just really eroding any sense of peace.
Do you think it's also that people at that stage, it's almost sadly because of what we've talked about with the system, it's like a last resort. So they've already kind of done and tried things, and then they're kind of coming to the site. No,
not necessarily. I don't, like, they're not coming to us because they're at their last attempt. Weirdly, 25% of all people, and this is out of 350,000 people, 25% are between 18 and 25 years old.
Right.
They're just curious about their reproductive health.
Okay, but like, they're still saying, I'm overwhelmed, I'm stressed out. Just because their lifestyles are stressed.
There's just, everyone's stressed and overwhelmed. Yeah. Like, it's amazing. In a weird way, technology has made everything so much easier for everyone, and yet it's damaging. Everyone can acknowledge the damage that social media and our lives and just constantly being able to be contacted is having. So that to me is something that just needs to be acknowledged so hugely. What's more is that when you think about this, again, comes to the ability to separate out and just isolate our organs and pathologies and be like, this is, we're looking at your reproductive health, and therefore we will ask about how you menstruate, how you bleed, any cramps, any symptoms related to that. But actually, when we look, we ask about a lot of symptoms. You know, what are you experiencing? Any of the following? And the top 10 symptoms, 5 of them are related to mental health: anxiety, low mood, depression, anger. And we cannot separate out our mental health with our overall physical and reproductive health. Like, it's insane to think that we know that our ovaries and our pituitary and our hypothalamus and are all so connected in this beautiful system that keeps us going, whether it's our metabolism, our sleep, our skin, our sex drive, our fertility, our menstrual cycles. We know that the organs in the brain are producing hormones and they're connected to the organs in our pelvis. And yet we separate. We say, let's cut your head off and only deal with your downstairs.
Sorry. Yeah, and that just made me think then of what we've all just collectively lived through over the last few years. If you think about the pandemic, I know it feels like so long ago, and we've all just moved on and we're all just getting on with our lives. You know, I was on a flight 2 weeks ago and I literally thought, wow, there's like not a single person on this flight is wearing a mask. And if you were to wear a mask, people would just look at you like, are you nuts? Why are you wearing a mask? But let's be honest, it wasn't that long ago you couldn't even get on a flight, let alone if you weren't wearing a mask, you wouldn't be allowed on the flight. So there's all this thing we've collectively lived through, this experience of fear, of anxiety, of stress, a trauma, you know, an emotional and mental and physical trauma. And not to mention having COVID and being ill. And I think that, you know, I don't know, obviously we don't really know, I guess, the long impact of that. But I think sometimes, I'll include myself in this, modern world is so fast and we're so impatient that we kind of think, yeah, but that was last year. Yeah, that was last year, Adrienne. That's not affecting me now. You know,
I was stressed about it. I coughed the other day and I was like, someone said, have you done a COVID test? I was like, that's so 2022.
Do you know what I mean? Throwback, nostalgic. But I think what I mean is that if something happened a year ago, Maybe something happened 5 years ago. Maybe something happened 10 years ago, which you maybe, you know, the body keeps the score. Maybe there's emotional, whether it's fear, trauma, stress in the body. And it's like, if we don't deal with that, whether it's, I don't know, people having talking therapy, doing more mindful practices, trying to down regulate their bodies out of that stressed
state.
Turning their phone off.
Like switching off.
Yeah, coming out of that stressed state to be able to, I suppose, like let their bodies do the natural processes, to heal, to rest, to be able to do the things it's supposed to do. Because I think we've all kind of just, yeah, tried to forget that it ever happened. But I'm sure there's a lasting impact on most of us when it comes to our mental state.
Absolutely. And not forgetting the fact that we all did wear masks and that we weren't around people and that we essentially suppressed, you know, everyone got sick as soon as we were able to, you know, see people again, because the bacteria that you're going to encounter with normal interactions with people is going to be there. You know, we, without wanting to be lynched, had thousands of people contacting us saying, I've had the vaccine and I'm waiting on my period so I can do the test, but it's not here. It's very frustrating as a scientist that topic has become something that you cannot talk about without being put as an anti-vaxxer or anything else. But
conspiracy theory saw that data,
and it was just, I guess for me, we tried to do a trial, but then a second wave hit and people became second vaccinated. And we just wanted to better understand. I was like, I'm not going to make any statement until we have the data. But we still have so many people contacting us saying it really messed them up. And we didn't put the safeguards in place or the necessary and so basic infrastructure to just ask people, did this affect your menstrual cycle? Let's ask. Yeah. Like, it was, to me, it was like the largest clinical trial that was conducted globally. And we messed up.
Because it was women's health, right?
Yeah. Nobody asked. Yeah. Nobody asked. It's very simple. Just ask the question. Allow people to monitor. Allow people to report, but that wasn't in place. So,
well, looking forward then, so if someone's listening to this podcast, I'm trying to think who might be listening to this. If someone's listening to this podcast, regardless of their circumstance, situation, age right now, why might they come to Hertility? Why might they go to the site? What would that look like? What would the process be like for them? So, for example, someone like myself versus somebody in their 20s who is single and maybe wants to have kids in the future.
I mean, I encourage everybody, irrespective of their desire to have children or not, to do a fertility test. Even though the name is Hertility and it sounds like for just fertility, we did start with that basic question, you know, can I tell if I'm fertile? Because we have included all of the different risk factors for PCOS, for endometriosis, for, you know, thyroid, for other hormone related conditions, for physical conditions like, you know, physical manifestations within your uterus, like adenomyosis or fibroids, because we've really taken into account all of the symptoms involved in all of those, it's much more of a broad gynecology screening tool. And to me, if everyone is almost shamed into getting their smear test, like you gotta get your smear test, otherwise you're an asshole. That's the scientific term for it. But we really do give each other shade if you haven't done your smear test. We're like, oh, I haven't done my smear, and your chances of cervical cancer are maybe 1 in 164, but your chances of PCOS could be 1 in 10, 1 in, you know, it's that to me is like, we all should be screening. Also, as we get older, your chance of developing a fibroid goes up. If you're a black woman, your chances is even higher. So that was essentially what we built into Hertility. That health assessment, though, when you sit and you do it, is quite lighthearted and sounds very informative. And we're using really positive language because we wanted to use that health assessment to both engage people, educate them, but also reassure them that the reason we're asking a question isn't just to find out. It's because there's a reason for it. Take, for example, we ask about if you've had any previous sexually transmitted infections. It's a personal question, but we need to know if you've had either chlamydia or gonorrhea, because those are infections that can sometimes block your fallopian tubes. Mm. So unless we know that and you had perfectly within range hormones, we're not going to be able to advise as to why you might not be getting pregnant, because you might have a blocked fallopian tube. So that helps us to encourage you to go for an ultrasound scan and have a look. So that is why I think everyone should do it. It just basically starts with a really comprehensive health assessment that you could do from your phone at home. And then following that health assessment, we'll assign a panel of hormones for you that's most appropriate to you. And as a baseline, everyone gets their ovarian reserve, their thyroid, their menstrual cycle hormones checked. But should you have triggered that maybe you have PCOS, we'll also test your androgens. So it's very much tailored based on the potential risk that you might have. And we built that based on all of the international diagnostic criteria and guidelines. So it's very robust. Like there's anything that's by the book, this is by the book. But also taking into account the fact that the books are outdated and are built on insufficient data. So we're constantly revising the questions that we ask. And our longer term goal is to redefine all of the criteria. Like redefine it per ethnicity. What's your risk as an individual? Redefine it per age group. What's your risk as at a certain age? And if you have any other comorbidities, if you have any other autoimmune conditions, taking the whole thing into account. Anyway, I digress because I'm never able to tell this story simply. you do the health assessment, you do the blood test from home, you post it to our labs and you get the results within a week. And the results take into account all of the things you've told us in your health assessment, plus the blood results. So we look at what are the things that could have caused your hormones to be either elevated or deficient. And what are the things that, you know, you've told us that might have contributed to that so that we're really extrapolating all of the information you've told us, plus your blood results in an online, kind of like a virtual clinic. Mm-hmm. And that's what it's like when you go through the experience, you view your results and the clinic door is open on your screen and it says, welcome to your virtual clinic. And there's a letter from the gynecologist, one of our team, and all of a full explanation of each of the hormones, what the hormone is, why did we test it, what it means for you, and then all of the actionable insights that you need. And then all of your next steps. So should you wish to speak to a fertility advisor, a gynecologist, a counselor, a nutritional support, they're all there and you can book in a consultation. Should you need a pelvic ultrasound scan, you can book in and have a consultation. Should you need a prescription, you can talk to one of our doctors and your prescription will arrive at your house that day.
Wow, so I'm going to run home and do this.
Yeah.
I'm not kidding. I think, you know, it's as you said, regardless of your, you know, whether you want to have kids right now, whether you don't, I think that information, and it's funny, I spoke to a dietitian on this podcast very recently and we were talking about at-home testing and she wasn't, of course, talking about fertility testing. It was more about intolerance testing. Yeah. And she was saying that she's kind of, you know, so sick of like these, the, you know, because the efficacy of them and they're not, you know, but there's no next steps for a lot of them. People just get this thing that says cut out all these foods and they're just left at home like, what? But actually, and it was quite funny because I said on the episode with her, I said, listen, I am the person who does all the at-home tests. I was just like, I am that person. Sell them to me because I'm always that person. And the reason I say it is because I do think that, you know, knowledge of your own body, being empowered to make an informed decision, feeling as though you have some, you know, I think there's nothing worse than if you've ever been in an experience where you've been to a doctor or maybe you've been in a hospital or maybe you've been with a healthcare professional where you felt really helpless and you don't know, you know, what even questions you should ask, for example. It's really just, I don't know, it's a really awful experience. And so I think maybe because of experiences in my life, I've just always been like, right, the more information you know about your own body, what's under the hood, the better. And it's not always going to be good news. Like, it's not always going to be a good news story, but would you rather not know, this maybe is for concern, or maybe this is not to scare you, not to, you know, scaremonger you, or to, but to drive you to take action? Because what's the alternative?
Honestly, nothing is as scary as being without any options.
Yeah, and this whole, you know, there's a reason we say ignorance is bliss, because it's, you know, it's not helpful, it's not useful to just kind of go, oh, well, I don't know. So yes, I'm definitely more on the team that's like, just everything. I'm like, everything. Every year, I'm like, I want to have a full MOT, just like I take my car for an MOT and service and pay for that. I'm like, can I have an MOT and service, please? Because I'm getting older.
That's one of my biggest bugbears, is that it is a legal requirement to have an MOT on your car, but nothing as a human being. So
it's like a fertility, MOT and service, you know? Great.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Okay, so what is next? What is next for fertility? Because you said, you know, the end goal and the end vision, but right now, you know, like, yeah, what are you most excited about, I suppose, as the founder of this company?
I am excited that we have just built version one of our app. It will not be ready until the summer because we are obsessed with detail. And so this is going to be an amazing companion. It's like a gynecologist in your pocket, whereby you can log your symptoms, you can log your periods, you can book a consultation, you can view your blood results. We're adding additional testing so that we can say, you know, let's let no stone go unturned. And this is really like this, you know, I mean, we have tools for almost everything, mm-hmm. right? We have apps for almost everything. I love City Mapper. It tells me how I will get to every location on every form of transport. And the infrastructure that is involved in doing that, it's very clever. But I want that for my own body. I want to be told whether I'm, you know, whether my hormones are imbalanced, whether the reason I feel like shit is because of something I'm doing myself, i.e. my lifestyle, or because there is something actually wrong with me. And so many people self-exclude from treatment or help because they just blame themselves, right? Mm. Is it because I'm not sleeping? Is it because I'm, you know, drinking too much, eating too little, or vice versa? And we're all very prone to blaming ourselves and excluding ourselves from the possibility that actually it might be something out of our own control and that something could actually help us. And
or that it's not real. But so, for example, the kind of chemical imbalance of the brain of a hormone that's missing, for example, like progesterone, it's that it's not real and it's just you just feel bad. So it's like, well, you know, do something that's going to boost your mood, or, you know, go to, you know, human connection, go and hang out with your friends, or like you said, you know, have a glass of wine, do something fun, listen to music, go for a run. The list of things you should do, you goes on and on and on. And so you're right. We berate ourselves and do those things and wonder why
still don't feel good.
Yeah. And if you've got a chemical imbalance in the brain and you're lacking a hormone, no amount of, you know, salmon and yoga is going to replace it.
Exactly. And quite shockingly, 60% of people, maybe 62 actually, we're constantly refreshing, but 62% of people who do a test have at least one out of range hormone. So and this is reflected in global statistics, right? Globally, we know that one of the most prescribed drug in the world is for hormone imbalance. So we should acknowledge that as a society, that maybe our hormones are under attack due to the external stimuli, chemicals, stress,
ultra processed food.
Like we should be fighting back and monitoring what our hormones are doing, because they are under attack and we need to look after ourselves.
Gosh, yes. Well, maybe that'll be the next thing, because especially now having a stepdaughter as well, I'm also considering the next generation of women and girls. And if you think, you know, some of the things that you just said, like the environment, and again, not to go into that box of a conspiracy theorist, but I heard someone this week talking about like toxicity, and essentially just like the toxicity of products and things that we're just covering ourselves with and spraying on ourselves and just putting in our air and on our bodies and on our skin, and thinking, well, does that relate? You know, is there actually
nothing
research?
Conspiracy about the fact that we are polluted from our products, from the atmosphere, from every aspect
but
of our lives.
But is there research that focuses directly, that's saying,
oh my God, the more research would make you sick.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Wow. Well, if we do a part two, Helen, then maybe we can dive into that, because it's something that, again, you can feel empowered by, because you can say, oh, actually, I didn't realize I'm going to go look at the products in my house, look at this ingredient and chuck it out. I'm not going to spray that on my face every day. Because of course, I mean, I am guilty as, you know, anyone else of just being like, oh, this smells nice. Oh, this feels nice. Oh, this looks nice. Put it on my skin. You know, do we really know what we're slathering on our faces every day?
I know. And we look and we examine the food that we eat and say, okay, I'm consuming this. And we don't apply the same consumption rule to what we put on our skin, but our skin is an absorbent,
the biggest organ. Yeah, the biggest.
And we are consuming chemicals on a daily basis through the skincare routines that people have. So
yikes. Save that for part two.
Yeah.
All right. Well,
I don't want to depress anyone today.
I know, I did say that, didn't I? It's like, this is the power hour, but you know, it's I've really enjoyed this conversation. I think it's informative and it's not scaremongering, but it's essentially information, and I've really enjoyed the conversation. So before we conclude, Helen, I have to ask you, because it's the Power Hour podcast, about the power hour. Now, the concept of power hour, put very simply, is the first hour of your day. Now, I've spoken to so many people on this show in the last 5 years about what they choose to do with the first hour, what they choose to avoid, if they have a special routine, if they just go with the flow, what time the day starts for them. And I always love this part of the show because I get to find out from so many fascinating, interesting, wonderful people what motivates them when they first open their eyes in the morning to get up and live their life and do their day. So typically, I know you have a young daughter, typically what does the first hour of your day include?
Every single night, my 4.5-year-old will get into my bed. It doesn't matter. I don't know. It's never a set time. Could be midnight.
Oh, in the night. She doesn't start in your bed.
Oh, no, yeah. Oh. She's, yeah, no. In the night, she comes in. And so in the morning, this morning it was 5:45. She will typically say, "Do you want to make a smoothie?"
Well, this is a cute alarm.
It is a cute alarm. So we go downstairs. My hard and fast rule is that I do not take my phone off airplane mode. It is kept on airplane mode until she goes to school because nobody gets access to my brain at that hour of the morning because we are essentially, like I said, eroded for the rest of the day. And it's amazing to think that someone can have access to your mainframe. Anyone, whether it's a notification on LinkedIn, an email, a WhatsApp, a text. I mean, it's unbelievable how impacted we are by notifications all day. And as a result, you go through this emotional roller coaster without inviting that roller coaster. You know, like when most people sit on a roller coaster and they strap in and they fade. Like when you receive a message that is like, "We need to do this." It's either stressful, it's happy, it's sad, it's, you know,
it could
funny.
Be anything,
it could be anything, but you are giving your attention to that. And so I opted not even that long ago, maybe a year ago, to say no one gets my attention unless I've chosen to give it in that my first few hours of the morning, because firstly, your cortisol is raised in the morning to get you up and get you going. And so you, those things actually impact you a lot more.
More, yeah.
Right? So I don't want to be impacted. I want to be able to give my full, undivided attention to my daughter because the day takes over. And I think those hours are special. So that's what I do.
Couldn't agree more. And it's great when you said that about LinkedIn. If you imagine, I often say to people, free time is not the same as availability.
Yeah.
And if you imagine like any person who could connect with you on LinkedIn, or someone that you work with, or someone that just like walking into your house at 6 o'clock in the morning, or even just they wouldn't call you, you know, for example, they just call you 6 o'clock in the morning and you're still like in your pajamas, just being like, "Hey, let's talk about this work thing that we need to solve today." It'd be so weird.
Or inevitably asking you for something.
Yeah.
And so without having done anything at all, you owe somebody something. Mm. And whether they've messaged you with an ask or not, they've still messaged you with the hopes of a reply. And so you owe somebody something. So you've started your day in debt. It's just, and I am in perpetual debt of owing an email reply or a WhatsApp reply. And I just,
oh my gosh, you should look at my WhatsApp.
It's basically
all these groups that I don't look at, because if you open it, there's the ticks. So basically, if I'm in a WhatsApp group, just you best believe I am not going to respond. No. I'm not going to engage. I'm not going to be active in the group. I am not going to read the message. So don't say to me, "Did you not see it in the group?"
I didn't. The amount of times people start a meeting with me, "Did you see my email?" No, I did not.
No. Especially if you sent it very
but
early.
It's very invasive. So yeah. I've decided, no, unless I'm choosing, you're not coming in.
Sounds like a good start to me. Dr. Helen, thank you so much for joining us today. I've really enjoyed this conversation. And
me
I
too.
Know, as I said, I've got a lot of friends who are going to be tuning in to this one. So thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks everyone for listening. As always, I appreciate it. If you think somebody would benefit from hearing this conversation today, then please, of course, share it with them and tune in next Tuesday when I'll be back with another episode. See you.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.